Hello and welcome to the sixth episode of Homer Grown. This is a bi-weekly show about gardening, agriculture, and local producers meant to encourage, empower, and educate gardeners. We strive to provide diverse voices by interviewing experts and garden enthusiasts. Although the name of this show is Homer Grown, our goal is to provide information relevant and applicable to the broader Kenai Peninsula. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. I am interested in growing my own food and being more self-sufficient. Thank you for listening. August is one of my favorite months. I enjoy when the weather begins to cool and the night sky returns. I feel most productive in August. I remember that winter is indeed coming. I think a lot about how I can preserve the summer's bounty and how I can extend my growing season a little longer. This episode, we're focusing on the now. How can we make our soils more viable? How can we protect and replenish them? How can we preserve the abundance? In this episode, we talk to Lori and Wayne Jenkins of Synergy Farms and Brad Kassar of Homer Soil and Water Conservation District to talk about fall succession planting and cover crops. Kyra Wagner and Catherine Shakey of Homer Soil and Water perform a skit about invasive species. And Nicole Arevalo talks about tools for fermentation for your Tech Minute. Let's get started. I want each one of you to introduce yourselves.
I'm Lori Jenkins. I co-own Synergy Gardens and the Alaskan Garlic Project here in Homer. We are near Fritz Creek General Store.
And I'm Wayne Jenkins, co-owner with Lori. We love working together on Synergy Gardens Farm, and we welcome everybody to learn more about what we're doing.
And I'm Brad Kassar, and I'm with Homer Soil and Water, and I'm their soils guy.
So my first question, I'm going to start with Lori. Garlic is a huge part of this farm. Do you have a succession of what you plant after the garlic?
Always, especially inside the tunnels. Some of the garlic is grown outside in the field, but about half of my garlic crop is grown inside tunnels. And I plant the garlic in the tunnels late September, early October. So those tunnel beds have to be ready to receive garlic. And then the garlic comes out early to mid-July, and I use those same beds to grow fall crops in the high tunnels. I'm growing those white turnips, those high curry turnips that are so delicious, fast-growing radishes, arugulas, lettuces, spinach, and kale, and actually even more radish after that. And so I'll have an abundance of food ready for market in October, September and October.
Do you use succession planting a lot? Is that part of your farm?
Always. And then the soil, we also use cover crops extensively to replenish the soil's nutrients. It's not just an amendment to replenish the nutrients, but it creates a really nice friable texture in the soil, all of those roots. And it's also a really good weed prevention. Wayne's actually the farm's cover crop expert, and he can speak to that about using cover crops actually much better than I can.
Wayne, I saw that you guys grow buckwheat. What other cover crops do you grow?
So we have tried a number of different things. We use buckwheat because it's fast. And we have such a short growing season here. And as Lori explained, buckwheat will come after an individual bed in a tunnel may have two or three crops. So it's getting toward the middle or late in the season. So you need something really quick. For overwintering, we use annual ryegrass and Austrian winter pea. And they're very, very hardy. We try to get them in before things get too cold. Sometimes they only come up a few inches, but then if there's good snow cover, they seem to survive pretty well through the winter. And this is outside. Then they'll come up in the early spring. So there's a, you know, it's a different approach for the two different environments. The tunnels are a very different environment. They have a very different timeline than outside. So you're trying to kind of come up with programs that match each system. But you're always trying to keep your beds covered with something. Bare soil is really kind of the enemy. We're also cropping these soils really heavily. 2 and 3 and 4 crops on a single bed in a growing season, that's a lot of stuff coming off that bed. So you're trying to replenish the organic matter, achieve all the great things that cover crops do. You know, they add nitrogen, they add other nutrients that they pull from deeper down. Like Lori said, they change the texture. They make the, you know, they enrich the soil. You just can't take. You have to give back. And that's part of the giving back is cover crops. The other part is compost. We do a lot of cover crops like phacelia and alyssum. Buckwheat's another one that bees really, really like. And we keep bees. So we're trying to expand the bee season, not just to be dependent on fireweed, but to also come in early and come in late.
So Brad, when we talked on the soil episode, you had mentioned you use cover crops. Would you like to talk about that?
Yeah, Wayne really hit the majority of what they're used for and their uses in the garden. They can be a huge help in the fall when you are harvesting things like garlic, and instead of planting into a vegetable, you enrich the soil with nutrition instead of using more of that nutrition for another crop. Yeah, they're doing a great job with keeping ground covered, which is what I do mostly to keep the weeds off and to keep erosion away. Keeps shape and improves the soil by adding all those roots to keep the microorganisms and all the bugs happy and fed and running around. And then you can either mow that cover crop right in to just mulch onto the surface, or you can leave it for springtime coming back, or till it in. There's a lot of options.
So my next question is for you, Lori. When you are doing the succession plantings, are there any plants that don't get along with each other? Like if you think about companion plants and how certain plants will thrive in the presence of another.
I don't use companion planting like I used to when I did small gardening. My farm, Synergy Gardens, is a market farm. And so my companion planting is likely to be when I plant my little baby cucumbers, I might line the full bed, which is about 30 inches wide, with young radishes. So I'll seed radishes next to cucumbers. Those radishes will come out and I'll have a nice healthy radish crop by the time the cucumbers are knee high, the plant is. So those are some of the companion planting practices that I use. I find lettuces grow great near other lettuces together, different varieties of lettuce.
Have you found this year that you have excess?
This is an unusual year. I sold to 12 to 15 restaurants weekly the previous 4 years. This year, many of those restaurants haven't even opened. And if they have, they've eliminated a half to two-thirds of their tables so that their restaurant guests can social distance. And with that, they're buying very little from us. So I've shifted to growing more food, actually, for our CSA families, but there are fewer customers coming to the farmers market. So I'm finding I have an abundance of sugar snap peas and abundance of long English cucumbers. I've usually sold so well and I go home with empty coolers. The tunnels have no COVID and they are just growing to beat the band. The loyal local customers come early and they're still there. They're still purchasing what they need. But there's just a difference this year with how much purchasing is going on at the market and throughout restaurants. This is actually a great year for growing food. We've had more rains in June, steady rains in July. So the crops are doing great.
How do you preserve your harvest when you do have excesses?
I don't have a whole lot of time like I used to for preservation, but I do blanch and freeze vegetables. I have a new dehydrator. I will mostly text message as many people as I know and say, you can come purchase food. I open the farm Thursdays and Fridays for on-farm sales from 1 to 6 and invite people if they need to get food, they want to come by, then we can do that. I usually open the farm up September and October for that. I'm not a big Facebooker, but sometimes I try to Facebook availability, and I'm navigating Instagram like I never have before and saying that there's this available and that's available. But, you know, the word of mouth way of selling vegetables is still very tried and true. Save You More is helping. They will carry some things. The Food Hub is a great way for me to list what I have and sell that way. We just need people to eat as many vegetables as they want. Now, there's no limit.
So what do you have planned to go into the ground, you know, in terms of succession planting?
I'm going to seed some spinach beds. I'm going to seed more radishes, more white turnip, and more arugula, because those are fast-growing crops, more bok choy. There's a baby bok choy and a full bok choy. And those crops will do well going into this time of year. And lettuces, full heads of romaine, little mini red romaines, those kind of things. And I have carrots that are just now germinating. So we're going to have a lot of carrots and beets, tons of beets.
Would there still be time if I wanted to grow things outdoors?
You know, that's a great question. Your fast crops like arugula and radishes, I would say, sure, give them a try. I'm really not sure if now you could get away with starting carrots from seed outside. Growing outside is what I'm allowing my beds that I've cropped to rest and use cover crops more so, because it is already the first week of August here. But radishes and those little white turnips and arugula, they'll grow fast.
Earlier you mentioned that instead of growing like a home gardener would, you take a market farm approach. What does that mean?
Well, I've always taken care of the soil as a home gardener. The difference is I'm growing for market. I'm growing for other people and thinking about what the market will bear. And it's also, this is my business. I'm not a retired person. I stopped my other career to be a full-time farmer. Kyra Wagoner and I have had great conversations about what does sustainable mean. Sustainable agriculture means it not only sustains the soil and sustains the community with food, but it sustains the farmer with their livelihood. The farmer needs to eat. Other than the vegetables you grow, I need to pay my bills. I need to have my vehicle for transportation to deliver vegetables. So the difference in a home gardener approach and my market gardener approach is I devote more than full-time hours to it. I have increased my self-discipline like I didn't even know I was capable of. And I get out on the fields, I'm working the fields, I'm finishing a row. I won't stop until I finish the area that, you know, I know what my target focus is to achieve the seeding or achieve the weeding or get my work crews happy and put together and trained and come back year after year. It's such a different thing. In my home gardener, I just grew a lot of flowers. I didn't want to make lists. It was my release from my other full-time job. It was a pleasure. Growing this garden, the pleasure is expanded because I'm sharing this food with literally thousands of people, not just me and my friends and family. And that is a huge shift. These thousands of people sometimes bring me back their compost, and it's an exchange of energy. It's larger than I ever imagined. I'll bring back restaurant compost, compost it, and put it in the soil. And it's like I'm helping that restaurant make their business viable by selling them food. They're helping me by helping enrich my compost and my soil. So it's a give and take with the businesses in the community, with the customers in the community, with the soil and with my family and with the work trade help on the farm and our interns. It's just so much bigger.
It's synergistic. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And it's community-based. Without people purchasing this food, we couldn't farm.
Yeah.
The people consuming the food are just as much a part of the farm as any other piece of it. Without them, the farm wouldn't happen. You know, one of the things that you asked, Desiree, was kind of like these differences between like a commercial operation and a garden. With commercial operation, there's barriers, there's challenges. For growing a lot of food, one of those challenges is labor. Most small farms cannot afford to pay help a living wage. That's not just true of small farms like us, it's true of giant corporate farms. People that work on those farms are usually underpaid. They don't have health insurance. There's just all kinds of problems. Our agriculture around the world is based on people doing the labor and really not being fairly recompensed. And that's a model that's really, people would love to figure out how to change. But people are also used to underpaying for their food in this country. We have a cheap food policy in America. If people paid the true cost of the food that they bought, and by true cost, I mean the water pollution, the air pollution, many cases, large-scale farms are subsidized by taxes, their prices would be much greater. We're not really paying the full impact, the full cost for food. And then, of course, our prices are linked to those prices that people see every day in regular stores. We're organic and sustainable, and we get a little margin, we get a premium for our food. We believe it's better food. But does it really reflect the cost of production? So there's lots of challenges to it, but efficiency because of what labor would cost or how to get all the work done, it all has to do with design. So all of the beds are 30 inches. We're using the same tools that Emily and a bunch of the other small commercial growers are using. It's a specific approach that Elliot Coleman came up with, and then a guy in Canada named Jean-Martin Fortier, he fine-tuned it. And it's a systematic approach because they're to get around these challenges and to help us be profitable. Because if we're not profitable, we're not going to be here.
Can you talk further about this approach?
Systematic approaches can produce a lot of something. If there's a lot of inefficiency, if there's a lot of steps, or you've got to walk to the other end of the farm to find a tool that nobody knows where it's at, or without efficient approaches, you work yourself to death. In a garden, you don't have to be that efficient. But as soon as you get larger, things become more complex.
To me, it's like an art form. You know, an artist is rarely going to get what the value of their time is worth when they go creating something. They're rarely going to get paid for the years of training that they put into their art project or their art making. And then when a garden or our farm is inviting to look at, it's inviting to work in it. You feel better. Your energy is higher. There's a book that we read by this guy, Ben Hartman, called The Lean Farm. And he talks about being able to find what you need when you need it and having it organized and appealing so that other people feel good in your space. I take that to heart. I do think of it as it is my art form. I'm growing living color. And then I think about people are, you know, like what recipes are they going to use to serve this food and how many people are they going to serve this food to? The funnest thing I'm doing lately are these little edible flower bouquets. And I say you get to graze your bouquet and no telling what people are going to do with these flowers.
So I want to include Brad in the conversation as well. Brad, you did a 3-year report about cover crops. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, it was in the same style of trying to approach cover crops in a fall planting. And so we worked with a number of farmers and put in a mix of cover crops, had some indoor plots and some outdoor plots, and tried to see if we could make it work and what it would do to the soil. Turned out to be challenging at some places, just mostly in timing. So the seasonality of things from year to year, being able to harvest your crop in time, to have enough time to seed and have good establishment and germination and enough of a cover crop to make an effect for the soil. And different farms, all sorts of different practices depending on tillage and labor. So it was really fun to trial it out, and each farmer, a couple of them took it up as more of a regular practice, and then others found other uses for it. For example, one exciting thing we found was If you can get a cover crop that will survive the winter, it can help in outdoor beds for drying up that moisture in the springtime as the snow melts, which will then lead to warming soils faster and earlier prep. So that was a big boost for some farmers, particularly in wet areas or in wet years.
What are some of these plants that you would overwinter?
Surprisingly, a lot of the available standard cover crops will overwinter. The ones that do best are grasses. So you've got barley and winter rye, not particularly annual rye. Also, clovers will overwinter depending on how much growth they have. Peas can overwinter. Usually we were not giving them enough time to really see who would germinate. It was either, depending on the farm, you'd till things in the fall or in the spring, or just flail mow it in the fall and plant straight into it. But I think there's a lot more trialing and experimentation to be done with all these cover crops and see what works best for each person's situation. There's a plethora of cover crops out there that are commonly used, but cover crops in their simplicity is really any plant that will cover the ground and return nutrition to the soil with organic matter. So that can be brassicas, that can be, last year farm had a whole field of sunflower that was turned into a cover crop. People should get creative and inventive and see what works best for them. The Homer Soil and Water District has a lot of interest in this because it's a regular conversation piece among farmers and grower community. And we would like to trial out a lot of different cover crops in our climate here. So we're seeking property to trial those out on, and we're looking at trialing about 15 different varieties of different seeds and then also seed mixes, because a mix of cover crops can be really beneficial. So we'd mostly just like to see how they grow, when they're going to flower, if you can pull off a spring planting or a midsummer planting, fall planting. A lot of questions to be answered, but yeah, mostly just available demonstration plots for people to come see these cover crops growing, what they look like, what their characteristics and habits are, and how they function in our little cosmic hamlet. That's the one.
Is this a program that is going to be rolled out soon or kind of more nebulous or kind of in the making?
This program is a little bit of a mystery, but how should I phrase this? We currently have funding to do some research for cover crops and to make demonstration plots. We need to get access to some land and figure out how to get these plots established, but we would like to roll this out in 2021 and need a few other things to get the ball rolling on that. We are looking at several different properties that some have access to irrigation or fencing or this and that. Some have already prepared ground. Some are, you know, just raw ground. So we're very open. Mostly what we're trying to find is something that's very accessible to the public. So it's a roadside attraction. People can come check it out, and it can be available for future years as a demonstration plots and demonstration gardens or farm for the community, and try to answer some of the farmers' questions that are in the community here.
So Desiree, your listeners may wonder, so what's the deal? Why does anyone need to know what these cover crops do, or why would you even use cover crops? Or there's a particular situation here in Alaska is, we have a very short season and we're cropping the hell out of these beds. We don't know, no one knows, whether it's sustainable. And cover crops are a piece of taking care of the soil, enriching the soil to bring it up to very high levels of fertility so that we're not mining it. We're not burning it out. You know, we can pass our farms on and they're more fertile than when we started. But no one's been doing this way here long enough to know the answer to that. And with our short season, it's even more difficult because we're using that time to crop and to try to make profit so we can stay on the land. So how do you shoehorn in these various different cover crops, and when do you do it, and how do you manage them? So we're really, because of our short growing season, really challenged.
You're breaking new ground.
Yes, yeah, it's true. And, you know, shockingly, I mean, this land has never been farmed. This is virgin land. That's not something you find in the lower 48. There's hardly any, no virgin land left. And so we need to take care of it.
And a lot of it with these high tunnels growing more and more, it's an even more intensified production system. So people are turning three successions in one season. So it's massive amount of organic matter breaking down in these tunnels and nutrient uptake. It's a mystery, like Wayne was saying. And so cover crops are one of the many parts of the puzzle that will help a sustainable system continue to function efficiently.
With Homer Soil and Water's future idea of this cover crop study, what are the questions that you guys want to answer?
We would like to start with a very basic demonstration plot, understanding of what cover crops are possible to grow here and what their characteristics are. Within that, we will be trialing out different ways to incorporate those cover crops, different timing for planting, different methods for planting and establishment. So most of the cultivation aspects of planting, if it benefits or if it is fine with just our seasonal rains outside, which is usually what cover crops can rely on. But a big part of it is timing. If you can get a larger crop of biomass from a cover crop, how much benefit do you get from that just by having an extra 2 weeks in the season? Versus if you were to have a small stubble and till that in, are you getting a benefit from that? Or is it simply the benefit of keeping weeds away and keeping erosion away? We don't even know the questions yet, I guess. And we want to inquire from farmers also what they want to know. So it's going to be a learning experience for all of us.
I want to know with cover crops if their root systems will break through that hard clay layer. Will those roots permeate and help break that down so that our drainage can be improved? Because that clay layer, it's hard and it's silty and powdery, and it doesn't really become soil. It stays clay. So your topsoil, your subsoil, your clay layer, I don't know if you want to do a plexiglass trial and see how deep with the same soil. You know, that would be something interesting for me to learn.
Absolutely. And that's a big question for everybody living on the bench in these beluga soils, is that layer. You know, there's all sorts of great photos of people in the Midwest with these giant tillage radish, but do they do it here? Do they go a foot deep? Do they go 2 feet deep? And do they break through those hard pans? Yeah. Big questions. And also, you know, a lot of brassicas have great taproots, but a lot of our brassicas stay fairly shallow in the soil because we have such rich soil and they're not digging deeper. I hope we can answer that question when it comes time.
You mentioned the tillage radishes. Yeah. There's actually radishes that are grown for this purpose.
Yeah, they intentionally are grown to create large taproots that open up hard pans or compacted soil and are left there in the field to rot and create a pore space for future roots and bugs to come in and start to work that soil so that it can have better drainage and improve the soil. Yeah, here at Synergy Gardens, it looks like things are really intentionally planted to keep the soil covered and to keep the soil nutritious. It can make a massive difference in just your labor for the amount of time that you spend racking your head on how to manage all these weeds and different patches that you don't know what to do with. And cover crops can be a really quick solution, which seems like you guys use regularly.
Lori, I notice you use a lot of mulch as well.
Yeah, mulch is awesome. In a home garden system, I used mulch everywhere. And it creates a fabulous layer between the soil and the mulch where worms are so happy. And worms are my my natural cultivators. But here, since I'm, like I said, growing for market, the mulch I use is on top of for garlic. I'm not mulching that much as a weed deterrent. But in other, like flower beds, mulch is important. And asparagus, I'm using mulch to keep the weeds down. And it will just be this fabulous thing where it decomposes slowly and earthworms are so happy there.
You guys use hay as a mulch too?
We do. We buy local hay. We talk to the hay growers about when they cut their hay so that it can minimize how much weed seed is in the hay. And it's up to the hay farmer when they cut their hay. You know, or with global warming systems, there's been a little bit of a shift. Things might mature a little sooner. It's a little warmer. So we've met some people who cut their hay a little early in the season before it all goes to seed, and people who manage their hay field so that it doesn't have a lot of weeds and weed seed, because we do not want to add that intentionally. But of course, there's going to be some of that anyway. I think that's where I got a lot of dandelion on the farm. I happen to love dandelion, so it doesn't bother me because I make dandelion root tea and I use the blossoms for different things, and I just happen to love dandelion.
So we've been really down on weeds like this whole chat. But weeds really are how earth that's been disturbed heals itself. And they're our friends when they're not directly competing with our crops, and they are building the soil themselves. Dandelion is a great soil builder. And I think Homer should probably name itself Dandelion Capital of the World. I've never seen so many dandelions in one place. When they're in bloom in spring here, you have to make peace with it to come up with ways to address the issues, but it's not like they're the enemy. Imagine trying to get rid of dandelion in Homer. What would that take? You would have to spray the most awful herbicides on thousands and thousands of acres, and you're still not going to be successful. All of these issues are so complicated that it's hard to find a black and white. I used to deal with National Forest in Georgia. We did oversight on the people that work for the National Forest. So we actually sued and stopped their clear-cutting program. But we continued on with our work, and it was amazing how much herbicide they spray. I mean, in the National Forest. So I can't remember the author's name, but there's a great book called Weeds and What They Tell. And I don't know if he was biodynamic or exactly, you know, what frame he was coming from. But it's a wonderful little book if you can find it. And he goes through all of these different plants that we think of as weeds or that show up in our cultivated, disturbed ground when we try to garden. And he tells stories about each one and what it's good for, the nutrients that it may be pulling from the subsoil and therefore depositing on top of the ground, how it breaks the soil up. You know, of course, we have to, in our gardens, we have to control weeds to a certain degree, but it really opened my eyes to they're really not the enemy. They're just doing what they do, and they're doing it because we disturb some ground somewhere. So then we inherit dealing with it. And dealing with it intelligently is better than just thinking, oh, they're all bad.
So what can the weeds tell us?
Well, they're indicators of condition. So pineapple weed we see here. You will hardly ever see it in really, really rich, deeply broken up soil. It loves compaction. Plantain, same difference. Comes in where the soil has been driven on or compacted or is hard or poor, and they're starting to heal it. Any piece of ground, if left alone, actually goes through a thing called succession. And it's not just a succession like forest succession, it'll be a succession in weeds. And over time, the weeds will shift as the soil gets richer and richer and richer. You pulled one earlier today, lamb's quarter. Lamb's quarter loves rich soil. You'll hardly ever see it come up in a compacted field, but it'll come up in a garden bed. So they all kind of have their place. They all have their roles. And even though many of these are from Europe, they're not even from the United States. And if you go to Europe, you will see a lot of our plants that are weeds there. And this is what we do. This is what humans do. We move stuff around. And so it's actually a fascinating study.
So I'm through with my questions. Is there anything that I've missed or anything that you wanted to add?
Well, Desiree, I hope you continue to seek out people in the community and have these interviews with them and, you know, expand outward as you meet people.
Who would you want to hear from? Or what are some of the topics that you are interested in hearing from local farmers?
I mean, there's so many different, this is the most diverse community I've ever lived in education-wise. There are astronomers here. There are weather people. There are ecologists. There are so many different types of educated professional people that I don't mix with. I'm too busy farming or whatever. But I think this kind of community radio at the personal level is so cool. I have a real interest in bridging this divide that we're all, you know, the whole Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal divide. And it's here in Homer. It exists here. It's all over the country. So how might we bridge that? By getting to know one another better. And if we're intentional about it, maybe we can start to build those bridges and get across all that, which is a big deal because our country is divided against itself.
And that was Lori and Wayne Jenkins and Brad Kassar interviewed at Synergy Gardens on August 3rd, 2020. Coming up next, Catherine Shakey and Kyra Wagner perform a skit about invasive species.
Hello, this is Catherine with Homer Soil and Water.
Hello, hello. I have so many weeds, just weeds. I've got weeds all over the place, and I want to be organic. I don't want to use herbicides. I just heard that vinegar works great, so I bought gallons of it, and I'm hoping that I can use that to just pour on my weeds and kill it. Now, is that true?
Great question. Thanks for asking, and I'm really glad you called us first. So vinegar can actually cause more harm to your soil than most of the herbicides out there. It's very acidic, especially that 20% acetic acid, which is essentially vinegar. It's stronger than your average household vinegar, but it will kill your plants, the leaves that are above ground. It seems to do best on young weeds that are about 2 weeks after germination, but it doesn't get into the roots at all. But it does get into the soil and change your pH pretty dramatically, and that means it can kill some of the good bacteria and organisms that you want in your soil. And if it gets into the water system nearby, it can harm aquatic organisms too. So, you know, there is a time and place for using 20% acetic acid if you don't want to use other herbicides, but that would just be probably a spray bottle on the leaves of some weeds that are pretty easy to kill in general.
Oh, well, I have tried everything from digging, mowing, and tarping, but I can't get rid of this reed canary grass. I would use an herbicide, I would, but definitely not Roundup.
Well, it's important to know some of the differences between herbicides. So there's selective and non-selective. Basically, what that means is if they're going to work on broadleafed plants or grasses. So believe it or not, glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, is non-selective. So it works on all plants, broadleafed and grasses. And it's actually one of the most benign herbicides out there because it really degrades very quickly in the soil and becomes biologically inert and binds to the soil. So it's not available to be washed into streams. Whereas if you're not careful, you could use the wrong herbicide on the wrong plant, and you could use one that's going to persist in the soil for 12 to 24 days or to up to 18 months.
Wow. Okay. So What happens exactly after I spray the plant?
Well, there are some herbicides that are contact herbicides, meaning they touch the leaf tissue and then they kill the leaves above the ground, kind of like that acetic acid. But there are other herbicides that are systemic, meaning the plant sucks them into its xylem and phloem or into its tissue layers and translocates it down into the root system of the plant. And that's really what you want for a lot of your weeds, is to get an herbicide that will kill the root system. Now, once it does that and it gets into the soil, it's degraded by a variety of means. It can be photodegraded by light. It can be degraded by microorganisms. It can be degraded just physically over time. The molecule breaks down, or water sometimes can break down. But every herbicide is different. Every chemical is designed to do something different, and it breaks down differently.
Well, I've been spraying the creeping buttercup on my property with Weed Be Gone for like 5 years, but it's still here. The plant's still here. Why isn't it working?
Another great question. So plants can become resistant to herbicides. And what that means is that they just develop a tolerance that means the herbicide stops working. Herbicides work in a variety of modes of action. Sometimes they prevent a plant from photosynthesizing. Sometimes they break down cell walls. They're usually interacting with the hormones of the plant somehow. And a plant can learn how to not be fooled and have its hormones shift directions, basically. The other thing about buttercup is it's pretty resistant to herbicides in general. So you want to make sure that if you're going to go that route, that you want to use something that actually is going to work quickly and eradicate it. Using herbicides long term is not recommended and not a good solution.
Okay. Well, this other thing I've got is this big, huge, beautiful Mayday tree, but it's right in the middle of this memorial garden of mine, and it's coming up everywhere. And I can pull up the little guys, but I need to get rid of the big one, or I'm going to have them forever. So can I kill it without hurting the perennials in the garden?
So with those Mayday trees, you really need to get into the root system. So we do recommend, if you're going to try to eradicate all the Maydays on your property, which is a good idea, it's best to use some herbicide just to get into that root system to prevent further suckers. Now, there are herbicides like glyphosate that have not been seen to have off-target or non-target impacts on surrounding plants. Some of the other herbicides that are a little more toxic, like a triclopyr or aminopyrrolid, will work. They work quite well at killing the bird cherry, but sometimes they can have some non-target impacts on nearby trees or shrubs. So you just have to be careful. There's no one size fits all for herbicide use. It depends on the plant species, the site location, what else is nearby. But yes, it is possible to kill the root system of your bird cherry without killing the nearby perennial and annual shrubs and plants.
Okay, so I get that not every herbicide is the same. When would you say it is appropriate to use herbicides?
Good question. So we only recommend herbicides as a last resort. A lot of these common garden weeds can be managed or at least kept at smaller populations through a combination of tarping and manual removal, and also fertilizing, trying to keep your soil healthy, basically doing things to help other things grow. But if you have a really aggressive invasive plant that's a brand new infestation, we call this early detection and rapid response, then it can be appropriate to use herbicide if you think you can entirely eradicate that population. So if it's a new population, it's a very aggressive invasive plant, and you know you have to kill those roots, then using herbicide, you should be able to eradicate it in a few years and just keep an eye on any seeds that may have been spread into the seed bank of the soil.
Well, I was going to use some vinegar, but now I can't. So I really want to get rid of my orange hawkweed. I was thinking, like, if I'm going to use herbicides, if they're different ones, I don't want to read all the labels. Can you just tell me how to do it?
Unfortunately, no. So All of these herbicides are highly regulated by the EPA, and they are manufactured in labs, and they are manufactured to do very specific things, and they all have different levels of toxicity. Some are appropriate to use near water. Some are not appropriate at all to use near water. You have to read the label carefully and make sure that the plant you're targeting is on the label, follow all instructions, and make sure that herbicide is appropriate for the site. Is it a lawn? Is it a riparian area? Are you going to mow your hay afterwards and disperse the material somewhere else? There's a lot to think about. You have to be a responsible user of herbicides if you're going to use them, and read the label because it is the law.
Okay, well, is there anyone else I can get to apply herbicides on my property?
Sure, but just make sure that they are a DEC certified applicator for pesticides in the state of Alaska.
Yeah. Okay, so what are my options besides vinegar if I don't want to use herbicide?
If you don't want to use herbicide, then I suggest you take really good care of your soil. Get it tested, find out what you need to do to get the pH and the nutrient level to an appropriate composition for whatever it is you're trying to grow there. Soil compaction, overwatering, lack of nutrients, a wonky pH, those can all lead to an environment where weeds can thrive. So the more you do to take good care of your soil and propagate what it is you want to be growing there, you're going to increase competition and discourage weeds from growing. Get to know the weed. How does it reproduce? Does it reproduce by rhizomes, stolons? Does it produce seeds? How many? How viable is it for you to mow it to prevent it from going to seed? Or are you going to stimulate it to grow more, like the orange hawkweed? So get to know your weed, take good care of your soil, and if you just keep at it each year, it's going to take some manual labor, but it's a good alternative to herbicide.
All right. Sounds like I'm going to have a plan then. Thank you much.
Thanks for calling.
Bye.
Coming up next, Nicole Arevalo talks fermentation tools for your Tech Minute.
Hi, I'm Nicole from Homer Soil and Water with your Tech Minute. Have you gotten over abundance of vegetables right now? Not sure what to do with it? Save it for later. Let's talk fermentation. You don't need much to ferment vegetables. A jar, a lid, some salt, maybe some water. That's all you really need. But there's also some fun gear out there to explore. Starting with vessels. For glass jars, wide mouth are best. A wide mouth allows you to more easily stuff the vegetables in by hand or with any tool you might use to press them down into their juices, like a fermentation plunger, which is like a wooden pestle with a wider flat bottom for pushing the vegetables down. You can also use those old-fashioned bale-top jars with a glass lid held down by wire clamps, and those have rubber gaskets. You can replace missing or cracked rubber gaskets to assure a tight seal. Make sure to check your local cooking supply store like the Classic Cook, or if not there, look online. Ceramic crocks are great for larger batches. You can sometimes find great old crocks at garage sales, or you can buy brand new ones from local potters. If you find a used crock, make sure to check it for cracks, especially if the interior glaze is brightly colored or decorative, as older glazes may contain lead. You can pick up a lead testing kit from hardware stores or online to tell if the glaze inside is lead-based. If your crock has a crack in it, it may still be okay to ferment in. The important thing is that it holds liquid and you can clean it well. You can test whether a hairline crack leaks by filling it with water, marking the fill line, and checking it over a 24-hour period. To make sure hairline cracks don't harbor unwanted molds or bacteria, scour the crock with vinegar, maybe hydrogen peroxide, and then wash it out with hot, soapy water. You don't need vegetable fermenting vessels to be perfectly 100% sanitized like you do for brewing. Vessels with hairline cracks treated in this way are just fine to use. If you have a crock that does leak a little bit, you may not have to abandon it. There are ways to repair cracks with beeswax and propolis, or with natural resins. You can also ferment in wooden vessels, cookie jars, crock pots. Get creative. Some people really like using food-grade plastic buckets. Considerations are that cracks may harbor bacteria, and some people have concerns over chemicals leaking out into the acidic environment. Do make sure to avoid using buckets that once contained things like building materials. And also avoid metal vessels, as the acids and salts in the ferment can corrode the metals and leach into your food. Moving on to lids. Mason jar lids, again, are metal and might corrode. Some people protect them by using plastic wrap, or you can get plastic lids that screw right onto the mason jar. And there are also a variety of lids that have an airlock, so you let the gases and pressure from inside the jars out without letting air in. And some of these, they look like the kind that brewers use, with a water lock sticking out the top, and others are a lower profile made of silicone. There are a variety to choose from. You'll also need to weigh your ferments down into the liquid. Some people simply use a plastic bag filled with water, or better yet, using brine from the ferment itself. That way, if anything leaks out, you're not watering down your ferment. Using two plastic bags is extra handy. You can also buy glass or ceramic weights made specially for fermenting. And if you're fermenting in a crock, consider using a plate weighted down by something heavy like washed beach stones. If you're going to use a wooden weight for your crock, just remember, wood can expand in the liquid, so you'll want to make sure you can get that back out. Other things to consider. A scale. Recipes call for a percentage of salt to vegetables by weight. A scale can help you get consistent results. And if you're using water, remember that common tap water contains chlorine, and that can inhibit the good bacterial growth you're looking for. Same goes for iodized salt. The iodine can also inhibit bacteria. And keep masking tape and markers on hand. It's always good to label and date your jars. For great advice on fermenting gear and technique, check out makesauerkraut.com or any of Sandor Katz's books. This has been your Tech Minute. Happy harvesting, Kenai Peninsula.
Hello, this is Kyra Wagner with Homer Soil and Water, and this week's roundup for our agricultural producers. Don't forget to support your farmers down at the Homer Farmers Market on Saturdays and Wednesdays, or Thursdays up at Anchor Point. And you can support your Alaska Food Hub farmers by ordering from Friday through Monday for a delivery at the Methodist Church for you to pick up on Wednesdays. There are also farm stands. Bob Durr's farm stand out on Ocean Drive, the Spruce Top Farm stand on Ben Walters. You can find out when that's open on the Spruce Top Farm Facebook page, or Oceanside Farm out on East End Road. If you're going to the Homer Farmers Market, most of the farmers there have ways to read your credit card or take touchless payments, so you don't always need cash. Go and figure out some variety of way to support your local farmer. If you're a farmer who has been shipping up items to help with your farm, whether it's fertilizers or tools or whatever, make sure that you get your receipts collected for the Farm Service Agency's reimbursement transportation cost payment. You need to have your receipts for everything, but you can get a portion of the costs of that transportation reimbursed if you get your reports in time. Now is the time to apply. And October is the time that they will require all those receipts turned in, so start collecting now. If you are a landowner, on the other hand, that just has some bird cherry trees that you would like to get rid of, let us know down at Homer Soil and Water. Catherine Shakey, our invasive weeds program manager, is available at 907-205-0235 to help you get connected to the program that would work for you. We can help you with manual removal or herbicide treatment, and there's even a program for $100 reimbursement to purchase an alternative ornamental plant once you've shown that you've taken out your bird cherry tree. Let us know. This has been Kyra Wagner with this week's Roundup.
That's about it for this episode. This show was produced at the KBBI studios in beautiful downtown Homer. I would like to thank Lori and Wayne Jenkins of Synergy Farms and Brad Kassar of Homer Soil and Water Conservation District for talking to us about succession planting and cover crops. I'd also like to thank Homer Soil and Water for contributing content to this episode. Our theme music is provided by local musicians Carly Connemack and Kevin Cope. Outro music by Kevin Cope and Ryan Black. We want to hear from you, the listeners. We want to know what questions you have. What topics are you interested in? We want you and your ideas to be part of the conversation. You can email any questions, comments, or suggestions to Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. I'd like to take a moment to talk a little off topic. I have many passions. One of them is hand paper making. This is the main medium that I use to express myself artistically. During the month of August, me and my collaborator Kayla Bloom created an installation that will change throughout the month, focusing on trauma and grief and how we are addressing that through our process of making paper. There is an aspect of community involvement in this project. Normally, I would not use this show as a platform for self-promotion, but me and my collaborator decided that all of our sales from our work would be split between the gallery and an organization that raises awareness for missing and murdered Indigenous women. Please come and see it. It will be on display in the Homer Council on the Arts Gallery until August 28th. And support the arts in Homer. Thank you for listening. You can catch the next episode of Homer Grown in another 2 weeks. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer.